So, namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo anittassa, the state, bhagavato, blessedness, arahato, breaking the spokes of the endlessly turning wheel, sama with some, fully sambuddhassa with that state of discovery. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Thank you for coming. I was talking a little bit last night again about refuge and what it actually is pointing at when somebody takes refuge in something. Whether they're taking refuge out of joy or out of fear or out of hope or out of boredom, whatever reason anyone has to take refuge, there is still this kind of quality of being open to something beyond what you know. Would you agree with that? Do you think that's true? If it's taking refuge, it would have to indicate something beyond what you already have, because then you wouldn't be taking refuge otherwise, would you? What do you think? You'd just be going over your past saying, no, I think I'll wear that jacket today, kind of thing. Does that make sense at all? Sort of? Think about it? Okay. That's fine. I like it when people think about it. And for most of us when we're, most of us when we're thinking about taking refuge, we're trying, either we're trying to get away from something, or we're trying to go beyond something. Getting away from will give you a temporary sense of relief or pleasure. But if you're trying to get away from something, the assumption is that you've already had an experience of it. Would that be true? Mm-hmm. And that you just don't want it to ever happen again. So if your mind is focused on that, it's always happening. I mean, you're not away from it. You can't get away from it. But there is a kind of a desperation in trying to find something that will make that not exist somehow. And yet fear is very important in terms of taking refuge. The fear of understanding that however much I know, however much you know, there is still no safety in where I am in this world. In this world. As I mentioned to you, didn't I? Oh, that was on the weekend, that the magnetic pole has left Canada. I read that in up here, coming up on the plane. That's fascinating, isn't it? That it used to travel 10 kilometers a year. They didn't say how long ago. Now it's traveling 40 kilometers a year. So, geologists speculate that one of the reasons for vast total changes of the entire surface of the Earth is when the magnetic poles shift. So what do you think? Do you think the Earth is safe?
Yes.
Do you? But what about the people on it? So I will slightly adapt my question. Do you think the Earth is a safe survival place for species such as we represent? How's that? Probably not. And if the magnetic pull has sped up 4 times its speed sometime in the measurable past, it's not that very long, is it, in terms of the Earth? So if it actually has been measured to be speeding up like that, do you suppose that any of the beings that lived on the Earth the other times that the magnetic pole shifted were aware that it was about to happen? They were probably just going to buy the equivalent of a newspaper that afternoon. Is that possible? Because do you like to know things like that? But some people don't, do they? Most people don't, do they? Most people don't like to know how quickly you could get West Nile disease, do they? Or food poisoning, or something stuck in your throat, or getting hit by a truck, or suddenly have a stroke, or you know? Any of you know anybody who ever had cancer? Could I see a show of hands on that one, please? Oh, for goodness sake. Well, that's most of us know somebody like that. Is cancer a curable disease? I don't actually think it is, is it? If I recall. Is it? How about life? Is it a curable disease? No. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So there is this quality in my mind of thinking that I am secure, which allows me to, you know, figure out what I'm going to wear tomorrow, or whether I need to get, you know, warmer socks, or, you know? There's that quality of the mind that continuously, it is the most profoundly beautiful aspect, I think, of our being. That part that is immortal as it rises and falls in every second. Because you know, in one moment you feel one way and then it dies, and in the next moment you feel another way and then it dies. You know that, you've seen yourself do that, haven't you? Before you have your first cup of coffee and after you have your first cup of coffee. There's a good example. And there's quite a difference between the two, isn't there? For me, before I have my first meditation sit. Really, don't talk to me before. I mean, you can if you want, but you're taking your chances. It might be a good day, it might not. And you probably have your rituals that you do when you get up, don't you? Some people get up and stretch. Some people wake up and bury deeper into the bed. We all have our pattern. And then a minute later, we're a totally different person. And then a minute later, we're a totally different person. And that is an amazing quality. There is a part of ourselves that is like a phoenix, continuously flying straight into the heart of the fire and burning to death, and then continuously being reborn from that fire. Just quite astounding. People who can't do that have a lot of trouble, don't they? People who don't have, for example, a good kind of screening power, what in Buddhism would they call ignorance. Ignorance is not a bad thing. It's very important. It's when you cling to some ignorances because you don't want to know them that it causes problems. In the Buddhist tradition, that's how that's taught. But without ignorance, you couldn't negate everything to focus on one thing, then let it go, then negate everything to focus on one thing, then let it go. Without ignorance, you couldn't be the phoenix. Because the phoenix has to come into form again. So in order to come into form, there's a whole lot of forms you can't be. You understand what I'm saying here, I'm sure. But ignorance is a profound power. To try to get rid of it would be to go into a coma. And as I've said before, I'm sure there's a lot of saints who are in comas. It's just a fat lot of good they're doing the rest of us that bothers me. That's the only... Yeah, they're very holy. And not that when we're not in a coma, we're saving the world or not saving the world or anything, but that there is some kind of form that has the power to be present, to have aspiration, to somehow be activating the elements. Because that's all we are, we're this bag of elements, actually a tube. You know that, don't you? You know you're a tube? Did you know? Whole? Well, a few, but mostly this one. Whole. A few little side channels there that go. And, you know, muscles here and goes round and round. Tube coils up a bit there, gets quite long. It doesn't ever tie itself in a knot, or rarely, and then comes out the other end, you know. And so here, these elements. Packed around a tube. Walking tubes. I mean, look at it. I mean, that's what we are. And sometimes we know it a little more, you know, you eat something that isn't quite right, you realize you're a tube a lot faster, but you don't usually think about it in those terms. But we're tubes. But we're tubes with motives. Would you say that's true? We have some very basic kind of motives. Nutriment. All the different types of nutriment. Basically, in order for the tube to keep carrying on with its tubeness, we need to keep supporting the hose part. So we keep needing to add the elements to it. In space, we need to add earth, water, fire, air in their equivalents in terms of food and liquid and heat, and don't we? And then there is this other kind of very difficult to describe. It's, what is it, 0.20 or 0.3 grams of weight that are lost between before a body dies and after a body dies? 0.03? I thought it was a little more than that. 0.03, okay. Right, thank you. There is this like just minuscule amount of difference in like that 1 second before you die and after you die. Did you know that? Isn't that wonderful? I mean, I think that's amazing. The things we measure is what I think. And we measure that. We actually measure that and can say, yes, when you die, when there is a death, then the tube weighs 0.03 grams less. So there is this some kind of energy, quality, aspiration, desire that is running the tube. That keeps replenishing the tube in order to manifest in space to act. Even non-acting is an action from that point of view. Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints yet?
So it's interesting with changing the speed of the magnetic shift to see whether that number changes.
Of which shift? Or the magnetic shift, yeah, to see what?
Whether that number changes.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be very interesting. I wonder if anybody does comparisons. Stuff like that. Yeah.
Huh. Ford magazine does stuff like that.
Hmm?
But they're still publishing Ford magazine.
Ford?
Ford was a guy who made a point of collecting all the information that nobody else was apparently interested in and compiling it and then cross-referencing and coming up with all these amazing balances and connections.
Well, we'll definitely both have to get a subscription immediately.
I haven't seen it for a while, but Max used to carry it, and it was just amazing. So the magazine carried on after he died, because they realized that he was actually onto something.
Yeah,
so
interest.
So he collected statistics on things, like frogs falling in Montana or whatever. And people say, oh, that's myth. And then he would look around the world, and he would find stories of fish falling on people. And then he started connecting the dates and that kind of thing and began to realize there was actual phenomena behind a lot of these folk stories.
So that he has his magazine. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, that's great. So that one part of all of the desires we have are these elements. In order to keep the tube running. And one part of all of these, of the desires we have, are these aspirations that ride the tube in order to manifest. It's a very Buddhist way of looking at life. And in a lot of the Buddhist teaching, the body is called the container, and the 0.03 is called the contained. It's very similar to the Christian teaching about a soul, as one United Church minister let me know that when I made a mistaken comment about a soul, he said, you should know that in Christianity and right back into the Judeo teaching, you don't have a soul, you are a soul. Which I was very glad to get that correction. That there is an energy moving which is not separate from the changes of the aspiration in a certain way, you could say. It's changing all the time, energy. And you know yourself that, you know, before you could walk, you had different aspirations than after you could ride a bicycle. Didn't you? And you can see, if you look, that over the years, you know, you really wanted something and then you got it and then you wanted it even more, or you didn't want it at all, or, right? That there are these continuous changes and shifts and understanding. So those kinds of aspirations or desires, some people use those for refuge. What you want to have a better position, or what you want to make yourself feel like you're safe, you know, that you have some stability, a good house, you know, a stable environment, a better car than anybody on the block, you know, those kinds of things. It can become quite a hunger, can't it? Do you think that's true? I live in Didsbury, I don't live in, you know, Whitehorse, so I'm assuming here, so I'll have to check with you on this one, but I don't know that, I don't think so many of you watch as much TV as people do in the cities further south. I think you actually believe you have a life, but that could be my problem. You know, I tend to be an idealist. But a lot of the people that I meet or talk with or spend time with have a very strong, almost unconscious obligation to become the cash cows of the economy. Did that make sense to you? Yeah. That somehow their job is to keep buying, because then when they're buying, they know the economy is good and everything's fine. And you don't look too closely at anything more than that. There is this sense that if I can just, you know, keep up and, you know, keep everything good, then everything will be okay. There's kind of a desperation in that, would you agree? I would not call that refuge. I would not call that refuge. I would call that hope. I would call that addiction. But I wouldn't call it refuge.
Would you call it ignorance?
It certainly is clinging to ignorance. Ignorance. Yeah. All of it is ignorance, because there has to be an I to ignore. But what it is one is ignoring is really the issue here. So I would call that, yeah, clinging to ignorance. And it's based to some degree on this fear that you might not have enough, that you should get the latest, that, and that is like continuously fed in a lot of our culture. And a lot of people don't have a chance. They're just raised with it. They come through school with it. They, you know, date with it. You know, and you see kids going to high school. You see what they have to wear. I mean, sure, they might like the classes and stuff, but there is this kind of quality of having to have a certain thing or look a certain way, and no sense of question about can you survive without it. Like even just for a split second, gee, guess what? The magnetic pole has shifted. Do you think you could survive if there were no department stores? It's an interesting question. And another one of the things that people often fall for in refuge, and especially again, in our culture where there isn't that much of it, you notice I'm just including you now and not putting you out, but outside of it, but I think it's easier when you're not in quite so civilized an environment to not get caught by these things. It's happiness. You know, all the ways people have of telling you how you could lose weight or how somebody lost weight. Oh, gee, you've really lost weight. God, you really look good in that. Why, have you lost weight? Or removing hair, or getting hair. On and on, huh? Why? Some kind of happiness will come from that. They laughed when I sat down to play. I guess you do you remember those commercials and somebody learned to play the piano from somebody or other? And the first thing it says, they laughed when I sat down to play. It was in all the old magazines and things. You don't remember that? Reader's Digest used to run quite a lot. No. It's the same. It's the same. The same thing that if you do this, you can be happy. If you do this, you can be happy. If you do this, you can be happy.
So when you talk about what we do for refuge, you're talking about the things we do so that we can feel safe or try to feel safe.
First one is because we're trying to make ourselves safe by possessions and possessions. Positions and possessions. Second one is by being happy or getting away from unhappiness somehow. Being, making sure you're happy, fixing everything up. If you just get the outer world set up right, then you'll be happy. If you just aren't with the person you don't like or are with the person you do like or, you know, haven't just lost the person you really like or the meal, or the, you know, anything. The desire for an experience other than that which is present is suffering.
Yeah.
Just by itself is suffering. It just is suffering. Desire for an experience that to continue without stopping is suffering. Desire to get away from an experience is suffering. And this desire to be happy is what drives all of them. And they are all basically not refuge. Trying to keep your world happy. You keep running around, you can adjust it all the time, but you spend all your time adjusting it. And the third way, and I don't think that's refuge. And the third way of trying to get refuge has to do with this sense of just having a good time. Damn the torpedoes. I'm going out to do it. I am having a good day. I'm already, man. Did you say, well, I'm just so, you know. And then you have these things like the hangover, or the people who won't talk to you anymore because you crashed a car, or all those other follow-ups, where your own pleasure becomes more important than everyone else's pleasure. But I mean pleasure with a capital P here. The other one is just happy, meaning I just want everything to go the way I want it to. But this one is like out and out lust. And it's a very different quality. And it doesn't matter how high you get, it's not going to last. Or somebody's going to have to give something up for you to have that. Isn't that exactly it? So that is not refuge to me either. And the fourth way that people try to take refuge is by being in control. Unfortunately, it ain't refuge either. Because however much you know, there's somebody around, however much I know about the Buddhist teaching, there's somebody around who knows more about autism than I will ever know. And I will never learn what they know. It's a little late for me to become autistic, I think. Isn't there an age limit on it? Yeah, so that that's why I picked it. I was hoping it was safe. Thanks. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like the powers and the energies and the flows of the world are so complex and vast, it's impossible to know everything or be in control of everything or be in on everything. Some of us are very, very good at it. But there is always a point where we got to learn to designate. In the old D word there, designate. Ask somebody else to do a bit of it. And the kind of fear and suspicion and sense of being cut out that comes if you feel like you have to know, that's very painful, isn't it? So we have these four ways that we keep trying to take refuge, and you know what? They're actually linked to the four elements. In a Buddhist tradition, the desire to keep building up your positions materially has to do with earth. As long as I keep trying to build up my position, look at the generosity of earth. Rather than trying to make it mine, but see its generosity with all the seasons, all the seeds, all of the flows and changes of this whole planet. The earth doesn't refuse anything, does it? How generous. Then I start learning the first step toward understanding something of refuge. I begin to be a little bit generous on my good days. And then I find out, gee, if I give something to somebody 20 years later and they really liked it, 20 years later I can still remember giving that to them. I feel good. And when I think about something I really wanted to bought for myself 20 years ago and then realize I lost it after 3 years and I didn't really care, it doesn't particularly impress me. And then, in fact, generosity has a much longer shelf life. And it takes up no room whatsoever. Huge reward, no storage. And if you ever saw my house, especially my desk, you would see how much I need that. So now I'm starting to learn something. I'm starting to learn that whoever I am looking at, wherever I am in the world, there is always the possibility of giving them something. My goodness, what an amazing idea. I could be happy about everybody 20 years from now, even if I think that person is a total prick. What could I possibly see about them? I mean, I know, they're not me, I know, but other than that, what else could Okay, I got to really think here. Well, I don't live with them. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, I know, but that isn't really giving them anything. They don't live with me. Yeah. Oh, aren't they lucky that they don't live with me? I give you the right to not live with me. Gee, already they look a little nicer. Holy. Holy. I wonder if, no, I better not say hello to them. No. Hi! Well, they smiled. How about that? That prick smiled at me. Huh, that's wild. And next time, I'm less likely to just use my ignorance to ignore them. Is that true? So I might notice they're actually not such a prick. They have this sort of kind of, when they walk, and they didn't really mean to knock that little old man over. I can't, don't pick on little old ladies all the time. Okay, little old man over. They didn't really mean to do that. They didn't even notice they did it because they stood on some ice just when they took an extremely painful step. And they didn't see that they knocked somebody over. And they're not actually such a prick. Well, maybe I could help them. Do you see what I'm saying, how it develops? It gets to the point that if you keep focusing on generosity, how you can be generous. If you see somebody who is like totally drunk and obnoxious and breaking windows, you're very, very generous and kind to them, you call the police. Because so far they haven't cut their hand or created something that they're going to have to be caught with much more than some windows, which they might be able to do some community work with. Is that true? Mm-hmm. You offer them protection. But you only do it out of a spirit of generosity, if you're practicing generosity. Doesn't mean you don't have fear. It means the fear is not motivating you. Fear is causing you to pay attention. What can I give that person? In fact, there are four ways in Buddhism that they talk about practicing generosity. One is called material. Can I help you? The other one is called dharma. Means tell somebody, you know, if you keep walking on that thin ice, you're going to fall in. Tells them something that's true, because they need to hear that. Third one is called protection. If somebody is totally out of their awareness of their limits, and they're like wild, and you can see them lost in it, protect. You either protect you protect somebody else, you protect them. But you give protection. And the last one is called kindness. Isn't that nice? Four types of generosity. And if you're actually practicing generosity, did you get all four? If you're actually practicing generosity, it starts to be fun, because now you've got options. You don't just have to go and, you know, give a quarter to every street person. You know? You actually have a way of practicing inner and outer the same. Material, dharma, protection, and kindness. Quite lovely. Now, you could do that whether you're a Buddhist or not, or, you know, I mean, that's like kind of human to me. And still, you're not doing refuge, but you're not doing refuge either. You're meeting a situation that you don't know, so there is that sense of unknown. But you're not doing it to go beyond yourself. Generosity does take you beyond yourself. But it's kind of a nice slow growth. So, if you continue working with the earth element, from rather than trying to shore it up, they have in the Tibetan tradition, they have this as a mandala, as a circle with pictures around it. And there's a gateway you have to get through, and the gateway that the earth energy is standing at, you have to get past this kind of, he's called a yaksha, he's sort of like halfway between an ogre and an animal and a person. That makes one and a half, doesn't it? Oh well. And he's sort of like, and he's standing on this step, this earthen step. And these waves are pounding against it. And he's continuously trying to shore it up, and the waves are coming. Waves are coming. Waves are coming. And you have to be able to get past that. That is to say, you have to not be that, trying to shore something up that's impossible to make safe. And how you do it is by those four, or basically generosity. Then when you have practiced generosity and you're to the inner courtyard, to the garden of the palace, because you're on your way to the throne room, then when you're inside, then you have this next option to do. It's like you can hang around there in the garden admiring the plants and practicing generosity. But maybe eventually you wonder what's going on in the throne. Who's in charge? So in order to find out who's in charge, you have to start looking at everyone and everything and every place you meet as the possible lover. The possible ruler, emperor, beyond self, the perfect thing. And that becomes what they call in Buddhism boundless beauty. And in the Visuddhimagga, they say that when loving kindness is fully developed, it becomes boundless beauty. And that's the process of how it happens. So the same desire that has us trying to make ourselves and our bodies work well, I need this for me. When you turn it around and start practicing generosity, and then you find you're starting to like things better, you start to like things better, you start becoming aware of the potential beauty of everything, when everything is boundlessly beautiful, then you have kindness. You actually are kind. Now you are no longer going to be caught by the struggle between the 0.03 gram and the hose. You know how to be kind inside and outside, and your aspiration is to maintain that quality of boundless beauty in your life. So then we come to the next one, water, which tends to get very much... Well, I should just tell you what the yaksha is that on the gate of water, and that, I think, that would make it perfect. Is that good if I just tell you about that? No, it should make it quite clear. The yaksha in water, he's got this rosary. And he's saying... oh yeah, this is fine, everything's okay, I did everything I need to today, oh yeah, it's fine, everything's okay, I got everything I need to do today, John, oh yeah, this is fine, oh good, everything's fine here, oh yeah, I'm okay, oh yeah, oh yeah, I'm just fine, everything's good, I know what's happening now, oh yeah, everything's good, and it says in the text, he's saying his mantra endlessly. His mantra is basically... I don't know if you've ever driven on a road when you were in a bit of a hurry. Any of you ever done that? Probably not. Any of you ever? Once in a while, maybe? And maybe you know, just for a moment, somehow you've got a really classy car, and you got a, you know, you got the CD player program, so it's hitting the songs you like. You got your like 12-disc CD player playing there, cruise control, of course. Got your coffee. I'm driving along. Oh yeah, I'm fine. Everything's okay. 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 The caribou steps onto the road. Jesus Christ! Hey, what? My road, my highway. But you're much too refined a crowd, I think. I've never done that. Is that true? Maybe once just to try it because you've seen other people do it, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
I think something like that, probably.
In high school.
In high school, right. Exactly. Yeah, right. That's, I think, when I did it. Oh, no, I didn't drive then. And what it says in the text is that he's saying his mantra endlessly until the beads break. I told you not to phone, get home. Whatever. You know, whatever. It can be so quick, can't it? And some of us go cold when we do it. One time I wanted to get my mama to go to a doctor's appointment. She decided she didn't want to go. She decided she didn't need to go to the doctor. Thank you very much. She was going to sit there and have a cup of coffee, and I would make it for her. Thank you very much. I said, but mama, we got, you know, I don't know, I was a little dull that day or something, you know. I mean, she'd been my mother all my life. I mean, it wasn't that I hadn't met her or something. But mama, you know, we got this appointment, you know. Things like that occasionally bothered her when she was younger, but when she was older, like, you know. And so she did her usual thing when she was really pushed at something. She went, so I recognized a little bit of that. So I made her a cup of coffee and set it down, and I turned the TV on, thinking, okay, we're going to be 10 minutes late, and started chatting about the thing on TV, and she's looking at it. She's like not drinking her coffee. She's looking at it. I said, oh, gee, look at the time after about 10 minutes, you know, because she's losing her mind, you know. I mean, you can slip those things in on old people, you know. Yeah, I mean, oh, gee, look at the time. Let's go get ice cream. You know what? She did that for 3 days. No, she didn't. She did it for a day and a half, because that was what she said. Right, she did it for a day and a half. We didn't go to the appointment. She did it for a day and a half. So the next day in the middle of the afternoon, I'm watching her. She's not eating. She's going to the bathroom. She's going to bed. She's getting up. I'm looking at her. Well, she's eating when I'm not there, but other than that, she's not eating. Not anything I put up. Thank you very much. And I'm sitting there looking at her, and suddenly I was overwhelmed by how good she was. And I was looking at her, and I went, you do that so well. That's incredible. And like, totally sincere. She turned around and looked at me, and she said, yes. She said, you know, one time I did it for 3 days when I was a girl. I don't know whether we're all that good. She had some brilliant moments, my mama, our mama. But that quality of like being in your own bubble and you're in charge and nothing is going to, and then something dares to interrupt. If you're reading a book or going to the bathroom or, you know, whatever it is, that puffoon, that just be almost before you can stop it, isn't it? Just kind of raging up. And so this sense of being comfortable and content and undisturbed, and then and another one of the Buddhist quotes, interrupted desire creates aggression. Very nice. Interrupted desire creates aggression. Doesn't me. Immediately, it's like a break. It's almost like, oh, there's a tiger just stepping out of the trees, you know, like, oh, red alert, red alert. But if you're not watching, it will just immediately go into anger. If you catch that adrenaline and use it, what does anger do? It fixates on an object, doesn't it? There's a subject, there's an object. What is it about that that is useful? The intelligence. of just this point. I've often used the analogy, you know, there's one fly hit the windshield over there. You can't drive now because it's too beautiful. You can, like, you see every detail of that fly. Or somebody does something you don't like, you're watching for them to do it again. It's just the way those stripes don't quite match when your arms are like that. I mean, you could have worn any other sweater, but no, you wore one. I bet if you looked in your clock, you'd have, yeah, and you wore that sweater once before, too, I remember. And all the evidence comes up. Just comes flowing in. And then you can't get your eyes off that. The power of focus that comes with anger is profoundly amazing. What we tend to forget in those moments is that we have the choice of where we want to put our focus. And when you actually start playing around with changing where your focus is, you find out that there's lots of space to play with. And that space is the most profoundly beautiful consort. You never had a better lover. You lean forward, space leans forward. You lean back, face forward. You cough, space says fine. You don't cough, space says fine. Isn't that true? How could you eat without space? I mean, everything about space is just like so amazing, continuously supportive. And if you actually put your focus on the spaciousness around something, or even on another time when a different event happened that wasn't so jarring, right? Any way you use the space to move your focus starts to open your consciousness to use that energy more appropriately, more according to what would be useful, not only for you, but for the other. So when you start to feel that desire interrupted, to actually start to be aware of the space you're in, the space behind your back, the space where you're standing, like that three breaths exercise that you showed me, Leslie. Mm-hmm. Like that's fine, or wiggle your toes, or whatever, you know. But anyway, just be aware of the spaciousness in which you're present. Then as you start to do that, you find that your intelligence is free to see what is happening, but you don't have to try to get rid of it right away. You can be present with someone if that's all you need to do. You don't find yourself hating being disturbed. You find yourself alert and present and willing to hear. Is there anything to do? Not only for you, but all beings. So when that sleep state of comfort and I got it all my way is transposed into a sense of spaciousness, and you start actually having the coolness to be present with someone and use your intelligence to see things as they are. Multiple choices open. And that's called compassion. So water itself, it says also in the Visuddhimagga, in water as the element, the interchange between that 0.3%, 0.3% and the element water, the flow between that, when you're not caught up in trying to keep yourself comfy, and you learn how to use the energy of being interrupted for opening your mind to the space around you, becomes the boundless, the compassionate boundless space, compassionate possibility. Now, if you don't get your own way, it becomes the option of, well, how many ways are there? Sympathetic joy is what happens with fire. The fire is basically inappropriate lust. It's inappropriate because everybody has their boundaries. And it is inappropriate for me to find my pleasure by overstepping your boundaries. That's harder though, isn't it? Because you have to go through a bit of a learning curve with that one, don't you? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to go through a learning curve with all of them, but that one can be quite a difficult learning curve. To learn how to be present with your desire without it aiming it at an outer object. Think, this is how I feel. I know I want this. All beings are equally beautiful. They all, whatever they want. This is what I wish I could get right now, and it's being interrupted. But there is the space around me to be aware that all beings also wish for this. And I am also aware that in this world, therefore, it's impossible to satisfy all desire. Now you start moving to the spiritual level. Now you start moving toward refuge. Now you take that desire and you open it like St. John of the Cross, go up the stairway. You pray. You open. You open your desire totally without object. Whatever your desire is, if it's for someone to die or to not die because of compassion, if it's based on compassion, whatever bitterness we meet, whatever fear we meet, whatever pain we meet, if we use it like a prayer and a question, it opens a different dimension. Because all of the pain and all of the suffering and all of the bitterness is inherent in living in time. There is no way out of that. If it ain't one thing, like Mae West said, you don't know who Mae West is, do you? She was a Hotsy after silent, film star. And she used to say things like, is that a banana in your pocket, or are you glad to see me? Other cutesy things. And how do I get off on this? I am a sick woman. I'm going to drop her. Let's leave Mae West out of Dharma tonight, okay? Rewind. Okay. But the whole truth is that there is no way that this world can ever remain satisfactory. The whole truth is I can be happy with what it is. It cannot make me happy. The whole truth. I can use my desire to transcend the physical. There is not a person, there is not an animal in my estimation, there is not any being on this planet that does not know this. This is not anything that everybody doesn't know. This is very straightforward. But whether we have the power to think that we don't have to do it the right way, that it is our right, it's our inherent ability to pray with an open heart, to like take those moments that seem like impossible, accept them as impossible, and then ask for a transcendent understanding. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking refuge. And the asking itself on these terms is transcendent. Because the subject now is dialoguing with an object that is boundless. Because there is no experience for it. Even if you use a name, even if you use a word, even if you say Buddha or God or Mohammed or Allah, it's still only to focus the mind to boundlessness, to beyond what I know. Is that true? So when you're doing that, you're moving out of your dialogue with the outer world, you're moving into your dialogue with the spiritual world or the spirit world, whatever you want. I know I'm making a bit of a false distinction, but nonetheless, I'm going to hold it there for the purposes of what I want to talk about today. The experience of that, says the Buddha, Vasuddhimagga, when you work with the experience of fire, which goes from pure lust to sympathetic joy, to, that is to say, the joy that brings you to a greater sympathy. Now, you're not trying for the outer to please you, you're using as an inner force. The result of that is a boundless state of consciousness. That the mind, to some degree, and often to a very great degree, has an experience that is profound beyond the usual sense of self. And when you stop trying to have power, but you sit still and you watch the flows of power, oh yeah, a drunk yaksha is the one that represents the sympathetic joy, vomiting all over everybody. I'm having a good time, aren't you? And the yaksha who is for air is doing this magnificent, wonderful drama. Even though he knows that he's not doing it, he's